You are listening to the Tricorder Transmissions, episode 47. And
now,
here are
Craig
and
Jeff.
Eyes out for giant amoeba as you listen to episode 47 of the Tricorder Transmissions. We are your hosts, Jeff Hewlett.
And Craig Cohen.
All right. It's good to be back with you again, Craig, this week, as always.
Yeah. I look forward to the times we sit down and watch Trek and talk Trek.
Yeah, it's always great stuff. So, very light news week. It looks like there is a parody Star Trek book, original series-based book coming out called Fun with Kirk and Spock.
Okay, what's that about?
And it looks as if it's drawn and presented in the style of a children's book. It looks pretty fun to me. So it was written by a guy named Rob Perlman, and he's done it in the style of a children's reading book. So if you remember from your younger days in kindergarten, first, second grade, third grade maybe, it's kind of big pictures with a little bit of text, short sentences type thing. And it looks pretty funny. The illustrations look really good. The artwork is looks like it's well done.
Neat. It's kind of wild how much industry Star Trek has supported or created over the last 50 years. And the amount of job creation based around Star Trek has to be, I think at this point, innumerable.
I agree. And think about it. I mean, we don't get paid to do this, but, without Star Trek, we wouldn't be sitting here every week. So
I was going to say, did you hear about the creation finally announced the 100th guest for the convention in Las Vegas? And it's a big name.
I did see this. So drop the bomb.
Yeah. So Harlan Ellison, writer of The City on the Edge of Forever, has been announced as the 100th guest. And it's kind of a big deal because he doesn't really do a lot of conventions. So really, really neat. And I think he's going to be on stage doing some kind of Q&A session. And then he's going to be set up in the vendor room meeting fans, which is really neat.
That's pretty awesome. And I hope that he has copies of the City on the Edge of Forever comic that he'll be selling and signing. So I would love to have one of those.
Yeah, he'd be a fool not to. And we all know that Harlan Ellison likes to make sure that, rightfully so, he gets every nickel and cent that is owed to him. So if he has the opportunity to peddle his wares in comic book form, he should go for it. And I think he was pretty actively involved with this book.
Yeah, he definitely was. And I think that It's one of those things where after all these years, his true vision for the episode is finally seeing the light of day in some official format. So it would surprise me if he didn't have that book available, the first part of the book that's been released available for fans to purchase and, ask questions about. Because I know I'd love to ask some questions about it.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of line or what kind of crowd interest there is. At these conventions, it tends to be the most hardcore of the hardcore fan base. But, you got to wonder how many people are interested in the really behind-the-scenes people. So I'm going to be curious to see. I know we've gone to conventions in the past here in Jersey, non-Trek conventions, where you always try and figure out, or you scratch your head at certain celebrities that have a huge line and others have like no line. And you can never seem to predict how those things are going to go.
It's so true. But I know that Five Year Mission is very excited about Harlan Ellison being added. I'd be surprised if the line wasn't decently long, knowing that you got a lot of people spreading the word about it. So I'm sure a lot of original series fans who are going to be at the con are going to be interested in seeing Mr. Ellison.
Yeah, I know I am. So it's very neat.
Yeah, definitely. We're going to be on that line as well. So we got an email from a listener in Australia by the name of Ian. Okay. I just wanted to give him a quick shout out on the show and thank him for, you know, submitting his comments to us. And he's got a lot of positive feedback to give. It was very flattering reading those mails. And I actually sent him a message back asking him if there were any episodes that he thought were standout episodes. And he said he thought all of them were.
Oh, nice.
So that was kind of a blush moment for me.
Yeah, it's that's very cool. It's great to always hear people that enjoy the show and take the time to let us know, because I know I listen to a lot of podcasts where I never interact with the hosts or the creators, and it's neat when people take the time to do that. So thank you, Ian, and I'm glad we help you pass some time.
Yeah, I wanted to put that out there for anybody who's listening to this who would like to interact with us, because, you know, obviously we love to hear from you, and hearing this email from Ian was phenomenal. And we have a couple of people who post on our Facebook, but overall, we have not as much social interaction with the show as we would like. So if you want to jump over to Facebook, we're just the Tricorder Transmissions. Look us up, you know, throw us a couple of comments here and there. We would absolutely love to hear from you. And if you do, we'll be talking about it on air. So you'll be immortalized on our recordings, you know, should you give us some feedback or even an iTunes review as well. That would be great. And we would read those on the air as well.
Yeah, I've been having a lot of fun on the Facebook page. I know the other day they added Star Trek VI back onto Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
So we posted about that, and we had a little discussion related about where part six, you know, sort of falls in everybody's, you know, top lists. And so it was kind of neat.
Yeah, I thought it was kind of fun that our buddy Matt thought that Star Trek V might be on the top of my list, though I haven't revealed my list yet.
No, you've got us all waiting.
Yeah, I had heavily defended Star Trek V a few weeks back, so it's not surprising to me that someone would think that I would put that at the top of my list. But once again, I haven't officially revealed my running order. So I'm kind of conflicted about whether I should reveal that this early in the game or wait till we get closer to the movies.
Yeah, we still got some time there.
Yeah, we get a little time. But all right. So that's about it for our news and updates section. So are you ready to jump into the immunity syndrome?
Let's go.
All right. So, The Immunity Syndrome aired on January 19th of 1968, remaster on April 7th, 2007.
All right, and I have the NBC press release that was issued on December 28th, 1967. Captain Kirk and his crew must destroy a virus which has annihilated three solar systems and another starship or suffer the same fate in The Immunity Syndrome on NBC television network Star Trek Colorcast, Friday, January 10th.
Very, very cool.
Yeah.
All right. So we are going to get started with our scene-specific commentary on the immunity syndrome in 3, 2, 1. All right. So here we are back with the Enterprise, and we're en route to Starbase 6 for a little R&R session.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing that instantly jumps out at me watching this episode was this is an episode where you really notice the lack of Sulu.
Yes, and I think it's actually kind of funny that later on we have a scene where the crew is around the conference table and you have this wannabe quasi-Sulu at the table as if they tried to make it look like Sulu was there. I'll point it out when we get there.
Funny.
But there's that stunned Spock face that I love. Yeah.
And this is like Lucas obviously watched this when he was writing Star Wars.
I was going to say that.
This is like Alderaan blowing up.
Yeah, because they're a ship with 400 Vulcans on it, just quote unquote died. And Spock was able to feel that, even though they're nowhere near that ship. And, you know, McCoy is really kind of rolling his eyes like, yeah, right, man.
Yeah.
You're full of it. How do you know? But he says that later on he goes into a little bit more detail, and he talks about how, you know, he was able to feel their minds dying.
Yeah.
So the mental screams, if you will.
It was as if 400 Vulcans screamed out in terror.
Oh, you even got the line. And then we're suddenly silenced. So Kirk's got his green uniform on, by the way, too. Worth pointing that out. That seems to be kind of a toss-up when we get that and when we don't.
Yeah. It seems like it really is a season two staple.
Yeah, I wonder if it was kind of one of those things where either the director told him to wear it, or he decided he wanted to wear it, or how that went down.
It really makes sense, though, because if you look at, like, you know, Chekhov and, you know, the helmsmen are wearing the gold shirt. So it seems like the captain should have his own color.
Oh, I agree with that completely. And I thought that, you know, early on, he looked too much like everybody else. And if you weren't really a fan of the show or you hadn't watched it, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know just by looking who was in charge.
Yeah. But the interesting thing is it completely changed, like, the cut of the shirt.
It did. Yeah.
You know, it's got more like of a
wraparound tunic. Yeah.
And then it's got like that piece that, I don't know, that pulls over.
Yeah, it's got like a, it's weird. It's a shirt, but it's not a pullover like everybody else's. It's more of a, you kind of slide your arms in and then wrap the thing around you.
Yeah.
So the Enterprise has been diverted from its course to R&R for an emergency mission. Apparently millions of inhabitants of a galaxy that had a fourth magnitude sun has just completely been wiped out by some unknown force. So millions of people have just suddenly died.
Oof.
And they're sending their crack team, their best guys to, actually, no, they're the closest ship once again.
Conveniently.
Yeah, they always wind up being the closest ship to whatever's going on. Probably not the most engaging stinger, but interesting that we get that. Another power that we didn't know Spock had.
Yeah.
So once again, another strange thing about this alien guy who we've been hanging around with for a season and a half, and we still keep learning new stuff about him.
So right.
Nice to keep throwing new stuff out there. Pretty cool remastered shots of the ship in this.
Yeah. Especially the one shot that's coming up later where it's sitting idle in space.
Yeah. And I like some of these ones that you get a really close up of the front of the saucer section. You can see inside of it through some of the windows there. So McCoy is now trying to figure out if Spock has something wrong with him or if he's telling the truth. And he's asking him, how can he be so sure that that intrepid ship with the Vulcans on it is gone? And Spock actually says he sensed it die.
Yeah.
So yet again, this could be another. He could hear the death scream of 400 Vulcans crying out over the distance. So, you know, I'm telling you, I was going to bring up the Lucas thing. I'm glad you brought it up first. But if you know Star Wars and you know that first film, it screams a reference to this part of this episode.
Yeah, Jedi Spock.
Yeah, I mean, maybe Star Trek did have some influence on that.
Oh, totally. It would be, I'd imagine it would be hard for Star Trek not to have impacted a lot of the movie and, you know, TV shows that, you know, sort of fell in that sci-fi realm after it aired, because, you know, Star Trek really was a game changer in terms of TV.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for sure. Yeah, I mean, it was really the first hard, smart sci-fi.
Yeah, and that this scene that just passed is a perfect example of that, and it's something that I was going to touch on a few times during this episode. But Spock and McCoy just had what I think may have been one of their most cutting and dramatic interactions throughout the entire series, where, you know, Spock kind of lets his veil down a little bit and really cuts into the history of man and the way humans think of death. So he kind of calls out McCoy saying, you know, when one person dies, you know, humans are all emotional about it. But when a million people die, you're kind of desensitized to it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, you know, it's a million people. It's a mass thing. Okay. But one person, you get all upset over it. And you know, Spock kind of really berates McCoy over that. And it makes for a really great interaction. And, this, I think, to me is one of the reasons why I love this show so much, is that it takes itself very, very seriously. And this episode, I think, is a great illustration of how serious they took this and how seriously the writers took it and how serious the actors took it. I mean, you're seeing a giant amoeba floating in space. I mean, you think, okay, that's kind of campy and silly, yeah. But there's no moment in this show, in this episode, where any of these actors even show for a moment that they think it's hokey, or they're always serious, they're always on character, they're always on script, and it's fantastic for that reason.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you hit on something that maybe partially answered a question that I had, and that was the conversation between Spock and McCoy there. I noticed on this episode, it seems like this might be like the height of the Spock-McCoy, like, bickering. I can't remember an episode where these two really sparred as much as they do in this episode.
Yeah, their interactions in this episode seem much more edgy and terse. They're not joking as much. Like, sometimes in the other episodes, they'll have a couple of, you know, exchanges where they're sort of poking at each other, but then they always have like a little comedic relief part where, you know, they'll have the little Vulcan eye raise or McCoy will snicker or something. But you know, in this one, it seems their interactions are very, very dramatic.
Yeah, and Spock seems almost a little vindictive, mm-hmm. or in some of his responses, it seems slightly out of character for him.
Yeah, almost a bit. Yeah, he definitely lets tiny bits of emotion show through as he,
he wants to prove that he's right.
Yeah, but he does it at the expense of human history. So he goes out of his way to point out what he thinks are flaws in humans and human history in order to illustrate his points, which he does other times, but he kind of usually does it in more of a funny tongue-in-cheek sort of way, like poking fun. But in this one, he's more serious and dire about it.
Yeah.
So we've got a hole in space that's opened up, and the hole happens to be in the shape of the amoeba, but we haven't seen the amoeba yet. And it's emitting some sort of energy that is causing some sort of harm to the crew of the Enterprise. So it seems like quite a large number of the crew have wound up in sickbay, and McCoy is kind of overwhelmed down there. And they all have, symptoms of irritability and fatigue, and some people are fainting or passing out. And Kirk is obviously frustrated, and he is kind of berating Spock for being the science officer and not having the complete data all the time.
Insufficient data is insufficient.
Yes. You know, I think that digs an entirely new hole for us to fall into. Is do you think that Kirk and the rest of the crew rely on Spock so heavily that if he doesn't have the answers, a lot of times they have no clue what to do?
I would think that, except that over the course of this series, it seems like Kirk really holds his people accountable for being the best at what they do. Because mm-hmm. we've seen Kirk really call out Scotty a lot of times. So I think that a lot of times maybe they are leaning on Spock a little, but I think from Kirk's perspective, he really just expects everybody to always be firing at the highest level.
Yeah, and that's, as a captain, he probably should, because they're in disaster scenarios more often than not. So everybody's got to be on point all the time.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, he really seems to lay into Spock there a little bit. And
yeah, yeah. And I think... Yeah, I think...
Go ahead, sorry.
I'm sorry. I think that's a product of him being, you know, stressed by this, whatever this amoeba is
yep.
You know, doing to them.
Yep, took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah. But the other thing there is, I think as viewers, we expect a lot from Spock.
Oh, absolutely. We've grown to rely on him to answer all of these unknowns for us. So
yeah.
The only thing he knows about this so far is it's not a solid liquid or a gas. It's just... there. It's a hole in space, apparently.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's going to be able to figure out some more things, but I think it's frustrating to Kirk and possibly the rest of the crew that Spock doesn't immediately have some sort of comforting answer. you know, like, how can we get out of this situation? And usually Spock's like, oh, well, you know, that's, it's this, that, and the other thing. You know, you would think that the Vulcans have been in space longer than humans, so they would obviously have answers to things that humans wouldn't have answers to. So yeah, maybe it's just, it makes the situation feel more dire when Spock doesn't immediately have some sort of a theory.
Oh, totally.
About what they're up against. And now all of a sudden, things have gotten worse, and all of the stars have vanished.
Yeah.
So, inexplicably, and the ship is not malfunctioning. Spock has co-signed on that, and he has no idea what happened to the stars either. So, more non-answers from Spock.
Yeah, and that's got to be, I can only imagine what it's like to travel through space on a starship. But I can imagine when you're used to seeing a sea full of stars in front of you, to have all of those vanish would have to be pretty, I'd imagine that would be a pretty trippy moment.
Yeah, and especially with this new bad news from Scotty that's coming through, that the ship has mysteriously lost 5% of its reserve power instantly. So there's some sort of a drain on the ship's power that he can't explain. Yeah. So Kirk is not getting answers from any of his top advisors. So Spock has nothing for him. Scotty's got nothing for him. And McCoy is confused as well. So Kirk is pretty much hamstrung here to know what's going on at this point in the game. So he's getting more and more frustrated visibly with everybody. So, and we're getting one of the red shirts in the background has passed out.
Yeah, so pretty good fall.
That was excellent fall. It was an excellent fall. He did catch himself there, but it didn't look like he was trying to avoid being hurt.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it wasn't like Ric Flair type falling, but it was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, not bad stunt falling. I like the condition alert monitor that you can see behind Kirk.
Yeah, that's a cool little detail I hadn't noticed.
Yeah. So we don't usually see that when they go to a red alert, we usually see the red little light flashing, but you don't always get to see that monitor screen with the words condition alert on them.
Yeah, we actually spend a lot of time on the bridge in this episode. I mean, if you really broke it down percentage-wise, this might be one of the most bridge-intensive episodes.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. We do spend this is almost a bottle episode, so you get almost the entire episode is spent on the ship. So we do see a shuttlecraft later on, which is kind of cool. We don't see them very often, but
yeah.
For the most part, we're inside the tin can, and we're flying around, but a lot of the time is spent on the bridge, and it's just a very dialogue-heavy episode. But two-thirds of the ship's personnel have been affected by this energy surge, this weird noise that's happened a couple of times. So the situation is growing more and more dire as we're getting closer to whatever this anomaly is, and Spock has elaborated a little bit. And I thought this was kind of interesting that the whatever they're traveling through is an energy source that's incompatible with their energy. So they haven't come up with the negative energy concept yet, but the energy that they're traveling through is a type of energy that they're not used to encountering, and therefore it's causing all sorts of disruptions with their biology and with their electronics.
Yeah.
So how do you combat something like that?
Oof, yeah.
You need a guy like Spock. But McCoy is going to tell Kirk here in a second that everybody on the ship is dying.
Yeah, that's got to be some tough news to hear.
Yeah, 430 crewmen, man.
Although if Kirk wanted to get like, into a really deep debate with McCoy, he could have said, well, we're all always dying.
Oh, there's that shot of the ship in the blackness with the lights on. That's kind of neat.
The static, yeah. And that was the first time I ever really connected the original Enterprise to the Next Gen Enterprise.
Oh, yeah, because that was always lit up.
Yeah, that shot made me think of the Next Gen Enterprise, and it really made that connection for me that those ships are a lot more similar than I initially thought.
Hmm. Yeah, as a guy who's not a huge fan of the model for the Next Gen Enterprise, it is kind of a neat connection to see this Enterprise all lit up in the blackness like that. That's something you don't really see very often. In fact, I don't recall seeing it very many times at all.
No, I actually paused the shot when I watched this and just, you know, took a couple seconds to admire the detail.
That actually looks like it would make a really great wallpaper for your desktop.
Oh, totally.
I might have to go take a screenshot of that later and make it into a wallpaper, either for my phone or for my my computer. That'd be pretty cool.
Nice.
So life signs are dropping on some of these patients, and looks like some people are taking it better than others, as always.
Yeah.
Spock seems pretty much unaffected. But now Scotty's even sweating it out. Look at how much he's kind of got the beads of sweat dripping down him. It's a tough call for Scotty.
Yeah. And here's Kirk. He made a comment to Scotty that he wants to try something that Spock suggested, and Scotty's very reluctant. And Kirk says, "I'll hold Spock completely accountable, and I won't let him live it down if he's wrong."
I don't know if that's very comforting to Scotty though, because he's very prideful.
Yeah.
Of the ship, and I think anything that he feels like anything he does that could put the ship into more peril wouldn't sit well with him, even if he was blameless.
Yeah.
In the situation. So.
So what was the concept there? Instead of trying to go in reverse against the pull, they're going to go forward thrust. Because it seems like everything's
reversed.
Is everything was reversed in this? This is the round table shot with.
He is. He's sitting in the corner there, and it looks like George Takei, but it clearly isn't, or at least I hope it isn't, because I would sound like an idiot. But at the end, when they all get up to disperse, you get a little bit of a glimpse of the guy's face.
Yeah, that's neat. That definitely seems like it was the intention.
Yeah, I would think so, because it's kind of a shame you have a convening of all of the minds on the ship to discuss the issue at hand, and poor Sulu isn't there. I mean, are we supposed to think that Sulu just isn't on the ship? Is he somewhere else? As far as the character is concerned, not the actor, but the character.
Unless we're in a batch of episodes where he had some really, really serious, like, botany-based stuff to focus on.
Yeah, well, you know, this is another one of those moments where I'm thinking something that you bring up a lot. If this show was made today, they would have to explain where he was.
Yeah.
You know, if a character disappears for two or three or four episodes of a series today, they always give you some sort of a context, like, oh, well, they're on a vacation, or, oh, they're on an assignment somewhere else. You know, if a character disappeared from Next Gen, oh, here he goes. That is clearly not Sulu, but meant to look like him. But funny. But yeah, I mean, I would think it would have, I guess they didn't think about it back then, but it would have been nice to have them explain where he went. You know, someone you've seen, you know, for a season and a half, you know, always in that chair on the bridge, now is mysteriously gone for half of the second season.
Yeah, and I'm surprised nobody's really done a comic series or a book series, you know, called like Sulu's Side Adventures.
We're dropping ideas on this show that seem to be getting made elsewhere, so maybe we should keep this to ourselves. My goodness. So yeah. Spock has come up with some theories here in the roundtable. So what he has essentially said is that it's the energy that they're flying through is a negative energy zone, and that's causing the drain on the ship and the people, but that's not the actual cause. The negative energy zone isn't the cause. It's an effect that's caused by something else that we're going to... That's a really cool shot.
Oh, God, yeah, with the coloring there.
Oh, that's awesome. But we're going to find out soon what the cause of this drain is, in this zone that we're flying through is an effect of that creature, if you will. But once again, Spock has also made... This was the episode where Spock had said that Vulcan had not been conquered within his memory, by the way. So that was the... Earlier on in the series, McCoy had made a comment about Vulcan having been conquered, and I had made a point about Spock later saying that it had never been conquered. This is the episode in which he actually says that.
Right, right.
So we had a little contradiction there in... in Star Trek history.
Yeah. Now, I don't normally try and analyze the titles of these episodes. A lot of times they're pretty obvious, but this episode, it's hard for me to make a connection between the title of the episode, the immunity syndrome, and the story of the episode. Am I missing something obvious?
I think you are.
Okay.
I think you are. So what happens near the end is that Kirk and McCoy have a conversation in which they discuss viruses invading the body, and this giant amoeba being a virus that's invading the galaxy or the universe, and Kirk and crew of the Enterprise are the antibodies who are going to fight it off. So in an essence, they are, the Enterprise is the universe's immune system.
Ah, right.
Fighting off the virus, yeah.
Excellent, excellent.
So interesting theory. I mean, when we get there, we'll talk more about it. But I think that's a kind of a neat concept. It reminds me of an 80s movie called Inner Space.
Yes, with what? Martin Short and Dennis Quaid.
Yeah, remember that, where he's inside the body and he's trying to get out, but he's fighting off all kinds of weird stuff that's in there. And I have to watch that movie. I haven't seen it in so long. But
yeah,
kind of reminds me of that. So here we
if I remember correctly, it has a weird ending.
It does have a very weird ending. So here's the reveal on the amoeba.
Great, great.
Yeah, and we're getting amoeba. Some very great classic musical cue, that tension music that Trek is known for. So Spock is saying it's the source of the energy drain. And, you know, between the remaster and the original, they did a very tasteful version of the amoeba.
Yeah.
They didn't overdo it.
Yeah, not surprising. I mean, their choices have been so... I know tasteful is a word that we've used a lot, but you can also say respectful, or a lot of care is put into those. And I know that recently the team that's working on the Next Generation Blu-ray releases have been winning some awards, and I wonder how many of those people carried over from the work that they did on the original series.
Oh, that's a great question. Very good question. Spock says that the amoeba is 11,000 miles long.
Yeah, that's another episode that, you know, sort of like the Doomsday Machine did. It really puts in perspective, you know, how big, you know, the Enterprise is, but then also, you know, how big some of these threats they encounter can be.
Yeah, I mean, 11,000 miles, that's pretty huge.
Yeah, I mean, that's beyond comprehension almost.
Yeah, that's ginormous.
You can go from what, New York to LA, and what, that's 3,000 and change.
Yeah, exactly. So it's the length of what, three or four, almost four, a little less than four United States lined up together. So pretty huge, but great stuff.
Yeah.
So imagine, this is another one of those moments where you see that giant amoeba. Imagine, you know, we see all kinds of stuff on TV and in movies today, all sorts of effects and things. But imagine sitting in your living room back in the late 60s and seeing a giant amoeba.
Yeah.
On screen. You know, that had to be a pretty cool experience. Like, wow. You know, that's pretty cool special effects back then. I mean, today, I know today it looks, you know, maybe people think it's cheesy because we have all these great CG, you know, effects, and we can make CG models look almost like real people now, and you know, but back then this was probably pretty cool.
Yeah, totally. So let's talk about the behind the scenes people real quick.
Great.
This episode was written by Robert Sabaroff, died in 2007 at the age of 72, and he had some Star Trek history after this. He co-wrote the Next Generation episode Home Soil. And he wrote the story for the Next Generation episode, Conspiracy.
Hmm.
So kind of neat there. And this was also the last episode directed by Joseph Pevney, who had directed, this would be his 14th and final episode. And he gave an interview with Starlog magazine in 1988 where he really detailed why he stopped directing for the show. And it was kind of eye-opening for me. So he says, when Gene Kuhn left the show, much of the discipline had gone. From the time I made Arena to the time I did my last show, there was a hell of a difference. The actors were already ingrained in behavior patterns, which didn't permit new inventiveness which was, as they felt, opposed to their character. That was the beginning of the problem. Bill wouldn't do certain scenes because, quote unquote, Kirk wouldn't do that. Leonard certainly felt that way and very strongly because his character was so deeply ingrained that he knew precisely how Spock would behave in a setting. This attitude on their part was right in certain respects, with the actor protecting himself, but wrong in the fact that their minds were closed to new inventiveness. Now I don't bend with that kind of stuff. The director is the director. You want to be a director? Go, be a director. But when I am the director and you're the actor, you make the greatest contribution you can, and I make the choices. I couldn't enjoy working on Star Trek anymore. The show's whole character had changed for me. So very interesting explanation from Pevney there. And I guess it was right for him to feel like he couldn't really make the call a lot of the shots that he wanted to anymore. But it definitely made me think a lot about, you know, the actors really taking ownership of their characters.
Yeah, and I think that speaks a bit to, you know, what you hear about the original Trek series and the actors having these egos and kind of being, you know, Shatner with his ego. And that seems to really illustrate to me that, you know, that stuff was probably pretty true, since everybody, you know, had these concrete ideas about what their characters were, and they wouldn't want to deviate too much from that. So that is kind of eye opening.
Yeah, I thought that was a neat quote. And then, it's great that, you know, he was able to talk, you know, openly like that without really being afraid. I guess at that point, his career was behind him, and I guess he didn't really have anything to lose by speaking his mind. But, you know, it's understandable that the director would really want to be, you know, the person who's ultimately in control on the set. And I'd imagine it would be frustrating if people aren't listening to you anymore.
Yeah.
But he was really an important part of Trek. I know I'm going to miss saying that name when we sit down to talk about these episodes. I mean, 14 out of 79 episodes is pretty amazing. That's
pretty significant, yeah. Yeah. So while we were talking about Mr. Pevney, Kirk has been put into a position where he's got to make what I think may be one of the toughest decisions he's ever had to face. So you've got both Spock and McCoy volunteering for what is being labeled a suicide mission.
Yeah.
To fly a shuttlecraft into the giant amoeba and do some scientific study inside to try to find some sort of a weakness that they can exploit to destroy this thing. And, you know, Kirk is kind of right in the middle of the fence, and he knows that both of them are capable and both of them are his friends, and he's got to decide who he thinks is best qualified. So he's got to try to unplug his friendship for these two guys and make an objective decision. He ultimately chooses Spock to go on this mission. But could you imagine being put in a position where you had to choose which of your two closest friends you were going to send to their death?
Yeah. No, that's got to be an incredibly difficult struggle. And the real amazing thing here is, you know, not so amazing for Spock, but is how willing to do it McCoy is.
Yeah, that is kind of a surprise.
You know, he, you know, not to say that it's out of character for him, but he seems very, very turned off to the idea of this being a suicide mission. And maybe that was just McCoy's way of really dealing with it.
Possibly. And McCoy, this is another pivotal conflict moment, is that Spock asks McCoy to wish him luck and McCoy does not.
Yeah, which is one of the things where later on Spock, you know, Spock says you should have.
Yeah, kind of yeah.
Which is another one of those sort of like biting moments that seemed a little un-Spock to me.
Yeah, maybe this episode is the episode where they both discover that maybe they should be friends instead of being always at each other's throats. Maybe McCoy and Spock both learn from this, and we wind up with Star Trek V later on when they go on vacation together.
So there we got the shuttlecraft.
Oh, I love that shot.
Yeah, launching out of the back of the Enterprise. Very cool.
It's the Galileo 7 too.
Yeah.
So pretty cool. And we get a little, the interior of this shuttlecraft looks a little more cramped to me.
Yeah, there's nowhere near the amount of seats.
Yeah, some sort of a lattice too that's been put up in the cabin there behind the pilot seat there. So I don't know if it's the back of it's closed off for some reason or not, but it does definitely look like a different interior.
Yeah, unless it was sort of like a conversion van.
Oh, that's good.
You know, where you can swap stuff out as needed.
Hmm. So did you happen to notice earlier when Kirk was in his quarters and he did his captain's log, he turned on some strange-looking device in order to do it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a device that I don't think we had seen before. I guess a little late to go over it now, but if anybody's watching this, you know, rewind it a little bit when you're done and check out that weird-looking device that Kirk used to do his captain's log. I don't know if that always sits in his quarters and he just doesn't really use it, but this is I don't recall seeing him using it very often.
Yeah.
Oh, and there's Spock has entered into the amoeba there. He passed through whatever membrane is on the outside of that thing.
Yeah.
And he seems to have made it through. And he says something very strange to me here. And coming up, he's kind of relaying some of his stats right now, but he says that McCoy would not have survived.
Yeah.
Based on what, I wonder?
Yeah, I mean, all he really did was fall off the chair, unless we're supposed to imagine that there was some kind of force that really drove itself through the shuttle.
Yeah, and so McCoy says, oh, you want to bet?
Yeah.
So we still have this weird rivalry going on between McCoy and Spock that's... It really does feel like this is reaching an apex, because I'm really not sure if any time in the past, if we've seen them kind of at each other's throats as much as this episode.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really seem like Spock needs to let people know that he was right. There's no satisfaction there for him.
Yeah, and there shouldn't be.
Yeah, unless there's a logical reason for him to want to correct somebody. But, I mean, humans a lot of times will correct somebody, you know, just to make us feel
right.
Smarter or, you know, more knowledgeable on on a certain, you know, aspect of something.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And it's kind of contrary to Spock's character, the logical character, that should have no emotional need for reassurance, for self-reassurance, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So... well, we're losing contact with Spock anyway, so I guess he's going to croak.
And that actually speaks really more, a lot more to the Vulcan experience overall is, you know, Vulcans don't have the same, you know, responses or a drive like the humans would. So it's really amazing that, you know, the Vulcans really would accomplish as much as they did, because what really happens when you take away the emotion, you know, and where is the satisfaction in things coming from? And it's amazing to think that the Vulcans didn't sort of just fall back and become an incredibly lazy race, although I guess that would be illogical.
Yeah, I guess the logic is what drives them, regardless of a, you know, goal-oriented way of life. They do what they feel is the logical thing to do. So I guess it's just a different way of thinking.
Yeah, the colors in this really pop for me. The blue in McCoy's shirt here.
Yeah, it's great, really, isn't it?
And the detail. I mean, that's really these remastered Blu-rays are really, really an incredible treat.
Oh, it's incredible! Everything always looks really good in these episodes, but that close-up of McCoy's shirt, you can almost see the texture in the fabric.
Yeah, yeah, and you actually see on the emblem, the insignia, you actually see the detail within there, indicating, I guess, that he's a science officer.
Yeah, it's pretty, yeah, definitely a huge, huge upgrade from previous releases. And if you watch the versions that are on YouTube, which are the original unremastered versions, you can really tell the difference.
Yeah, it's great. I know in November they're releasing on Blu-ray and DVD Batman 66.
Yep.
And I know that they've they've touted that these are remastered. So I'm very curious to see how that show looks after it's cleaned up. And I know there's a lot of crossover talent on those two shows, and we've talked about people that have appeared on both. But I'm kind of excited about that, you know, having seen what they did with Trek, and they won't really need to do any special effects work, but still just running the film elements through the cleanup process and, you know, restoring and preserving. And it's great that they're able to do this.
Yeah, I agree. I saw the trailer. It looks pretty cool. So I'm sure it'll look just as good as Trek does. So those fans who are waiting for that are going to really, really love that. So we've also learned now that this amoeba has stored enough energy that it can now reproduce. So we've thrown another timer into this situation. So the ship is losing power. They have an hour or so of power left, and everyone is going to croak, and the thing is going to divide into two amoebas. And now we're going to theorize that if it keeps expanding and keeps dividing, it will eventually take over the entire universe.
Yeah, to take a line from Aliens, game over, man.
These things are animals. They cut the power. Yeah. So the funny thing, and Spock, his life support is minimal, and he's definitely seems like he's done for again. So we've got a lot of tension going on in this episode as far as the deaths of the crew, the death of Spock by himself, and the eventual destruction of the entire universe. But now we've got McCoy and Kirk talking it out, and Kirk is going to come up with an idea on how they can destroy this thing by just through McCoy talking about how they're the antibodies of the galaxy.
Yeah.
Invading the germ. So this is an interesting concept to me, isn't it?
Oh, totally.
Yeah, because I remember when I was a bit younger, there was something that I had read where I'm not sure who it was, but somebody had theorized that we, the Earth, was actually an atom and a part of a larger organism. So we're like this tiny little speck within another body kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, that's pretty interesting to think that, you know, we think we're on a huge, gigantic planet, but we're actually really minuscule and tiny and part of another larger, greater being, if you will.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what this is. This is kind of the same type of thing where maybe the Enterprise is really, really tiny and they're coming up against what they think is a really giant single-celled organism, but in actuality, you know, they're like a little speck.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So here we have really the effects of the PEDs that Kirk's been on this episode catching up with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Kirk's been on stims for the entire episode, as has most of the crew, and McCoy says that they do catch up to you. So yeah, it looks like everyone's going to start crashing here soon. So yet another timer.
Yeah, and there's a moment where Kirk says, just give me enough for, you know, enough juice for another hour.
Yeah, and he's like,
and then after that, it won't matter. We'll either be dead, or we'll be out of this and I can go crash.
Yeah. Well, now they're engaging what appears to be a last-ditch, very risky plan. So Kirk has told Scotty to, you know, punch it and get them inside the amoeba and, you know, utilizing most of the energy they have left. And I guess the logic is they need to get inside to enact whatever plan, you know, Kirk is going to come up with here, and it doesn't matter if they blow their energy. Wow, that was a serious rock there. But it doesn't matter if they blow out all their energy because they're pretty much dead anyway, right?
Yeah.
So you might as well take a last stitch, you know, and blow everything you've got and try to. Now, that's a really cool shot of the inside of the amoeba, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, totally.
That's awesome. So once again, these guys that did these remastered effects did a fantastic job.
Yeah, and we've talked about earlier in this episode, we talked about how unique Star Trek was and groundbreaking it was, but this is one of, you know, a lot of episodes where the quote-unquote villain of the episode really doesn't have anything more than a physical presence.
Yeah.
Which is, it's hard to pull off.
No, that's a fantastic point, and I hadn't even thought of that. I'm really glad that you said that, because it doesn't have any dialogue. You know, it doesn't have any face-to-face confrontation with any Enterprise crew members. It's just a giant, unmoving thing in space that it doesn't even actually do anything.
Yeah.
It's just consuming energy around it, right? It doesn't attack the ship, and, you know, it's not firing any lasers or torpedoes at them. But, you know, it's just a large, immovable, seemingly indestructible object they have to overcome.
Yeah.
But you definitely feel the tension that it creates, and it's not just the monster that creates the tension. It's all of the things that are happening on board the ship that add to it.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very well written episode, from my opinion.
Oh, yeah, totally.
So the plan is they're going to take this antimatter probe, inject it directly into the nucleus of this amoeba, and then back off and detonate it.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're assuming is that the amoeba will not be able to handle the antimatter energy and will therefore be destroyed.
Right.
So kind of a sounds like a risky plan, as they don't really have the energy to escape. And here's Kirk asking for another dose of the stimulant, enough for another 7 minutes, he said.
Oh, yeah, 7 minutes. It wasn't even an hour.
Yeah, and Spock is going to... Now, this is an interesting Spock moment for me. He's dictating what he thinks is his final personal log.
Yeah. Which really probably would never be found.
Probably not. Well, yeah, probably not. I mean, we have to assume that once the shields are gone on the shuttle, it would be crushed by the fluids inside the amoeba, you might think.
Yeah.
But he's going to record commendations, and his highest commendation and testimonial to the captain and the officers of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that seems almost like an emotional thing to do as well. But oh, maybe totally. He just wants that known.
Yeah, and we just had Kirk there, you know, hit that panel, and I got worried that he might jettison the pod.
Oh, man. We're never going to get away from the jettison pod button. Now, I wonder if the camera were to focus on that control panel, if the sign was still there.
Yeah, the jettison pod.
You know, maybe they just never took it off. You know, they put it on for that episode. And they're like, well, we're not going to take another shot of it. I'm going to take that off now.
Yeah. And now here's Kirk doing the same thing that Spock did, where he's recommending commendations.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And and he mentions Mr. Kyle in the list.
Yeah.
Not Sulu.
No.
Sulu doesn't get it. So that makes me think that maybe Sulu really isn't on the ship.
Yeah.
Maybe Sulu is off the ship on another assignment somewhere, because, you know, Sulu, I think even though Sulu wasn't on the bridge at the time, that if he was on the ship, Kirk would have mentioned him in that commendation list by name, because he's been through a lot of the heroics of previous episodes. He deserves to be listed there.
Yeah. Maybe like he transferred in the Tribbles episode when they were on that space station.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe, you know, Chekhov or Sulu stayed behind there.
Hmm.
Although Sulu's not on the Tribbles episode either.
Nope. Now, maybe he's hanging out on the shore leaf planet. Studying the plant life, maybe. So we're assuming, the Enterprise crew is assuming that Spock is now dead or lost.
Oof, yeah.
So, I mean, now the last thing that they're going to attempt is just to destroy the amoeba and you know, try to get out of there. But it's still looking pretty dire. Looking pretty dire.
Oh, yeah.
They've just succeeded in getting their probe lodged into the nucleus. So at least that part of the plan went right.
Yeah, yeah.
And Kirk is getting the ship backed out in a straight line to use the least amount of energy possible, so that they can potentially have a minute chance of surviving once the explosion happens and the amoeba is destroyed.
Right.
So you got to think, even if they do survive, they've got no power left. I mean, they're pretty much going to be floating in space dead.
Yeah.
So you would, yeah, I guess they would have to call for some sort of assistance and be rescued.
And then, now we're going to get a moment that I've seen on the internet a lot, and I couldn't remember what episode it was from, but it's McCoy and Kirk nodding to each other.
Hmm.
Which I've seen as a GIF.
Oh, I've seen that too.
Where, you know, somebody just cut them in, you know, back and forth where they're just nodding to each other continuously.
Oh, that's great. I've seen that. I didn't realize what episode that was from either. There's yeah. the nods. There are the nods. And there's a comedic moment. So McCoy told Spock to shut up because Spock doesn't want them to try to rescue him. And Spock says, well, thank you, Captain McCoy. So we got a little comedy there.
Yeah.
And I guess we learn that McCoy doesn't actually hate Spock and he's glad that Spock's alive.
Yeah.
So maybe this was their moment where they decided that they needed to back off and treat each other a little bit nicer.
Yeah. Yeah. That's got me wondering, though, if that's something that I need to consider for the essential, non-essential nature of this episode.
Oh, good call.
You've just muddied the waters for me.
Oh, man. I'm telling you, I'm good at that. I'm good at that. We're good at changing each other's minds or swaying each other, aren't we?
Yeah, oh, totally. And that's cool. And I think it's also neat that... that there are different viewpoints related to what makes these episodes essential or non-essential. And, I think that's a really cool aspect of what we're doing.
Yeah, I completely agree with that point. And I'm getting excited to talk about the essential portion here in a few more minutes.
Yeah.
But we've seen that the amoeba has been destroyed.
Yeah.
It is completely gone. The stars are back. And they were somehow miraculously able to keep Spock in a tractor beam, despite the fact that the ship was completely out of power.
Yeah.
So pretty neat. And Scotty just said that power is coming back somehow.
Yeah, and he says, I don't know how.
So I guess the ship is capable somehow of generating power. Or maybe the explosion of the amoeba expelled some of the amoeba's power and the ship is able to somehow absorb it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure how that works, but we won't question it too much. Well, Spock is alive. Everybody's happy now, and everything is resolved.
Mm-hmm.
So we're bringing the shuttlecraft on board, and there's a really cool shot. I love these remastered shots of the shuttlecraft landing.
Yeah, yeah.
That looks so neat. Imagine if you saw that back in the 60s.
Oh, my God.
That would have been mind-blowing.
Oh, totally.
Yeah. Well, they're going back towards Starbase 6, and we are going straight on into our essential discussion.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so you want me to go first?
Please.
Oh, geez. Oh, the pressure's on. So I'm going to do something here that I don't normally do. I'm going to invoke something that I don't normally invoke. And I'm going to say that this episode for me is not essential. I don't think that Spock displaying the power or the mind power, knowing when Vulcans have died, I'm not sure if that really counts towards essential. And I mean, there's a lot of great character moments in this episode. Phenomenal stuff. You know, the relationship between McCoy and Spock is really front and center. In this episode, Kirk making tough decision. I mean, he makes tough decisions all the time, but there's a really tough decision he makes here. But I don't think that stuff is enough for me to make it essential. But what I will say is that this episode, for me, fits into an honorable mentions type category where you don't necessarily need to watch this to get the Trek story and learn about the characters. But if you have some extra time, and you want to watch an episode that's really cool character-wise and very dramatic and well-written, I think this is a good episode to watch in that respect.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I'm going non-essential. And you had me wavering for a minute with the Spock and McCoy stuff. But like you said, there isn't really anything here that doesn't eventually get hashed out in other episodes. So I think you're completely on point calling this an episode that gets the honorable mention or the extra credit, letter grade assigned to it.
Cool. All right. So that brings us to the end of episode 47 of the Tricorder Transmission. We are just rolling right through these, man.
I can't believe
how fast time is going. We're coming up on our 1-year anniversary of the start of production.
Yeah, very exciting.
Yeah, incredible. So that's the end of the episode. And as always, catch up with us on social media. Twitter is TTT_pod. We're on Facebook, the Tricorder Transmissions. And you can catch us on our own website at thetricordertransmissions.com. And thanks to everybody who listens to the show. And any more thoughts from you, Craig, before we go?
Nope. I'll talk to you next time.
All right. Take it easy, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Due to the expensive costs of opticals for the immunity syndrome, other aspects of the production were held to a minimum. In fact, the only guest is the one-celled creature created by Vandeveer photo effect artists. I wonder what the SAG scale is for an amoeba. Joe Pevney, who directed this episode, also directed 5 other Star Trek episodes during the first season. He started out as an actor, and then went on to direct a long list of feature films, including Away All Boats and A Man of 1,000 Faces. A TV veteran, Joe's name can be seen on the credits of The Rockford Files and The Fugitive, among others. His first Star Trek episode, Arena, was also writer-producer Gene Kuhn's first. A tireless worker, Joe could take a script that should have been shot in 7 days, make it all come together in 6. He was an invaluable member of the team.